You are listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Stay tuned for the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss. Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum, a weekly show of news, information, and commentary by and for the working people of Kansas City. This show is produced by a team of volunteers from a broad range of workplaces and unions. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any unions involved. Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. Tonight's show is being underwritten by the Greater Kansas City AFL-CIO and IBEW Local 124. The Greater Kansas City AFL-CIO is a federation of 57 unions on the Missouri side of the KC metro area, representing 12 million working people in all walks of life. It advocates for them with elected officials at City Hall, with employers and the media. And the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers supports the Heartland Labor Forum. We've been wiring Kansas City since 1905. Yeah, they wired KKFI. If you are not finding your electrical contractor at IBEW124.org, then you're not getting the best value for your money. The Heartland Labor Forum and KKFI thank our underwriters for their support. On tonight's show, we're deviating from our published schedule. We're going to be celebrating 100 years since some women won the right to vote. What can we learn from that struggle for today's fights, and what's it going to take to get women into the U.S. Constitution by passing the Equal Rights Amendment, and why would working women care? We'll talk to Erica Benson from Project 28MO, fighting to get Missouri to ratify the ERA. In the news, KC tenants go statewide and demand Governor Parson and Supreme Court Chief Justice stop evictions and declare a six-month rent moratorium. And no joy for top post office executive after public and worker outrage mount against him. Our feature at the end of the show is Know Your Rights with Angie Williams, and she's going to talk about what to do if you're discriminated against at work. And now for the news.
Now news from our side, August 20, 2020. PAI reports the big ride-sharing apps Uber and Lyft are breaking California law by misclassifying their drivers as independent contractors and not employees with worker rights. Now a San Francisco judge is ordering them to follow it. Not only that, but the State Labor and Industries Department decided on the same day to sue the two firms for wage theft, too, for that same misclassification reason. In a 34-page decision on August 10th, Judge Irwin Schulman of Superior Court of San Francisco, the trial court level in California, approved the state's demand for a preliminary injunction against the two firms' drivers' misclassification. That means they must stop doing it. Schulman held off imposing his edict for 10 days to give them time to prepare for an appeal, which they promptly promised to do. Nevertheless, the ruling was a full scathing criticism of Uber and Lyft's prolonged and brazen refusal to obey state law. No firm, no matter how wealthy, is above the law in California, State AFL-CIO Executive Secretary Treasurer Art Pulaski said when Attorney General Javier Becerra originally sued. Uber and Lyft should immediately follow the law, stop cheating drivers and taxpayers, or face serious legal consequences of refusing to do so. Last year, California passed AB 5, which sharply restricts when firms can classify workers as independent contractors. But Uber and Lyft haven't complied and are appealing to federal court and have pumped millions of dollars into putting a referendum on this November's ballot repealing AB 5. Meanwhile, they continue to engage in wage theft from at least 5,000 drivers, according to the California Labor and Industries Department. And in a late-breaking note, NPR reports an appeals court has given Uber a reprieve until September to figure out how to comply with the law.
Today, the Coalition to Protect Missouri Tenants held a virtual press briefing to provide updates and tenant stories on COVID and the growing eviction crisis, and to release public demands directed to Missouri Supreme Court Chief Justice George Draper and Governor Mike Parson. Dozens of Missouri organizations signed on to a letter calling for Chief Justice George Draper to institute a six-month statewide eviction moratorium. The signing organizations include the Missouri NAACP, the ACLU of Missouri, the Urban League of Kansas City, Arch City Defenders, KC Tenants, Action St. Louis, Empower Missouri, and more. Tiana Caldwell, a KC Tenants leader, highlighted the cruelty, racism, and danger of the current rash of evictions.
Tenants across our state are hurting, and you, Justice Draper and Governor Parson, can take action to help them. In Jackson County alone, well over 1,600 evictions have been heard by the courts since the eviction moratorium expired on May 31st. Evictions occurring in person risk COVID-19 exposure to judges, litigants, and court staff. Phone and video eviction hearings impose significant financial and technological barriers, the consequences of which will be most acutely felt by those struggling the most to afford rent. These hearings also raise significant questions about due process and access to the courts. As always, landlords file evictions at disproportionate rates in Black and Brown neighborhoods, reinforcing decades of racial inequities. Eviction is already a fundamentally traumatic event, both a cause and a condition of poverty, and the pandemic only adds more anguish. Some people will move into motels, shelters, and cars, or double up in other housing units. Others will end up in the streets. All of these circumstances pose great risks to individual and community health, especially as COVID-19 cases continue to spike across the state. We cannot ignore the alarming disparity in COVID-19 deaths. While representing 11.5% of the Missouri population, Black Missourians make up 1/3 of COVID-19 deaths in the state. Let us be clear. Evictions are a death sentence for our most vulnerable neighbors.
Kalila Jackson, the senior staff attorney at the Metropolitan St. Louis Equal Housing and Opportunity Council, said, "Justice Draper, you have the legal authority and a moral duty to issue a statewide eviction moratorium in order to prevent mass evictions in the state of Missouri." And Rachel Roman, a Kansas City tenant facing eviction, said, "I don't understand how our elected officials can come up with money to protect a corporation, but not to keep us safe in our own homes. COVID isn't the only thing killing us right now. Poverty is a pandemic, too."
And the attempt to destroy and or privatize the U.S. Postal Service by the Trump administration and its new Postmaster General, Louis DeJoy, has been met with energetic and broad opposition by the public. Indeed, the Postal Service is essential for everything from voting to getting your medicine on time, and for many, their Social Security checks. Any changes at the post office, of course, also affect its many thousands of workers, and the unions, especially the largest, the American Postal Workers Union, have been very outspoken in their campaign to save the post office. On Wednesday, APWU President Mark Dimenstein issued a statement in response to DeJoy's backing off changes to cut back service. He said, in part, "Postmaster General DeJoy's mid-July implementation of a series of new policies slowed down and delayed the mail. These included the arbitrary cancellation of overtime, limiting mail transportation runs, and demands that everything run on time, even if it meant leaving large quantities of mail undelivered. APWU members made outstanding efforts exposing the negative impact of these policies on postal customers. He said they went to the media, they organized rallies, and they called Congress, and as a result, many spoke out, including other unions. There was, he said, a sustained chorus throughout the land in support of the public postal service and postal workers. As a result, yesterday, DeJoy had to back up and put off changes at least through the November election, and he promised to help states meet their growing vote-by-mail needs. That's quite a turnaround, but the battle continues because it'll take a lot more to save the post office. That's the news from our side. The news tonight was read by Tom Gepkin, Jen Zaman, and I'm Judy Ansel.
August 18, 1920, Women's Suffrage Amendment ratified.
Women have been fighting for the legal right to vote since the 1840s. In 1890, the National American Women's Suffrage Association, NAWSA, was established with Susan B. Anthony its leading force. But women have been fighting for their rights since the very beginning of time. First they said we couldn't dance, then said we couldn't drink. And unless a man allowed it, they said we couldn't think. They said we shouldn't speak till we were spoken to. Well, there was just so much back then we weren't allowed to do. But the first bite of the apple, I guess, revealed the truth. That's when Eve got smart, and that's why Adam got like fruit. But that old tree of knowledge had some limbs that broke. We had to fight for women's rights. They said we couldn't vote. It is the duty.
And of course, that's Dolly Parton singing a song called 19th Amendment, which was written for 27, the More Perfect album, which was for the podcast More Perfect about the U.S. Constitution. I'm Judy Ansel, and our guest for the show tonight is Erica Benson. Erica's the founder of Project 28MO, which stands for the Missouri Fight to Pass the 28th Amendment to the Constitution, the Equal Rights Amendment. She's currently its ERA campaign coordinator. Project 28MO is a Kansas City-based organization with the mission to make the Equal Rights Amendment the 28th constitutional amendment. Project 28MO works to unite and organize ERA advocates across the state of Missouri and Kansas. Erica is a mother of two young daughters and an American history teacher. Welcome to the show, Erica.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited.
Yeah, it's great. And tell me first, where do you teach history?
I teach in the Blue Valley School District.
Okay, so you're a high school teacher.
Yes.
Okay, well, I'm glad that some high schools are putting women's history into their curriculum. I assume you are.
We recently reworked on the Blue Valley curriculum, and so you would be pleasantly surprised at what the American history curriculum looks like.
Great. Well, I'd love to see it. And actually, I have a labor curriculum I could send you.
I'd love that.
Yeah. Anyway, I'm delighted that we could arrange this interview hitting the same week as the centennial for women's suffrage in this also important election year. And Erica, I first want to talk about the history of the suffrage movement. And then later on in the show, I want to talk about the Equal Rights Amendment and why working women need the ERA. So let's start with news from today, or actually from Tuesday, the day of the centennial. 100 years since women got the right to vote, at least some of us, and we'll talk about who did and who didn't. But President Trump, in what could only be seen as a cynical political opportunist gambit, pardoned Susan B. Anthony, who voted illegally in 1872 and was fined $100. The best takeaway was Kathy Hochul, the lieutenant governor of New York, who tweeted, "As highest-ranking woman elected official in New York, and on behalf of Susan B. Anthony's legacy, we demand that Trump rescind his pardon. Take it away. Take it back," she said. She was proud of her arrest and to draw attention to the cause of women's rights, and she never paid the $100 fine. Let her rest in peace, someone. But and someone then asked Trump if Trump planned on calling Anthony to give her the good news.
I didn't hear that part.
Yeah, I guess that was a reference to Trump's thinking. Who else was it that he thought was
Frederick Douglass?
Frederick Douglass was still alive. Yeah. Anyway, so Susan B. Anthony was one of our foremothers in the suffrage fight. One of many. Can you give us an overview of the fight to win the vote for women?
Sure. I mean, really, a lot of the birthplace of the women's suffrage movement in the United States starts with the anti-slavery movement. So many women were involved in the anti-slavery movement and were various forms of abolitionists, and they had to form their own separate groups because the men wouldn't allow them into their anti-slavery societies, black women and white women. They weren't allowed to speak in the spaces with men. And but in their own groups, they learned to, become better public speakers. They had argumentative skills. And so they grew in their confidence and their, political power. And in 1840, many women traveled to the World Anti-Slavery Society Convention in London, and women were not allowed to speak, and they were seated in a different space than the men at the convention. And in attendance was Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Lucretia Mott, who were very offended by this. And when they came back, they determined that they needed to have their own convention to talk about women's rights in the United States. And so in 1848, they met, and it was a very small group of people, like 100 people at a church in Seneca Falls, New York. And Elizabeth Cady Stanton was just a mother. Her father had encouraged her education when she was young and helped her tutor her, but her education was still limited, and she was a woman of wealth, so she was expected to be a lady and have kids. She was nobody, she wasn't anyone of national influence. But while at this convention, Frederick Douglass from nearby Rochester attended. And while they're at this convention, she lists grievances and problems in society with various forms of discrimination against women. And at the very end, she talks about the fact that women should have the right to vote. And that was highly controversial. Many people did not sign the Declaration of Sentiments just because of that fact, that was a line they had crossed a line there. Even her husband was questioning it. But Frederick Douglass did sign it, and it made national news. And from there, several different women's suffrage organizations were formed. But really, the Civil War got in the way. And after the war was over, there was a fight over who would be included. If they were going to make these new constitutional amendments, women should be included as well as African Americans in winning the right to vote and making it constitutionally protected. And that didn't come to fruition for women, and the 15th Amendment was ratified, but women were not included. And so you saw a breakup in the women's suffrage movement. There are two different organizations, one that opposed the 15th Amendment because it didn't include women, and that included Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony. And then the other movement, which was led by Julia Howard, or Ward Howe, and Lucy Stone, and they're the AWSA, and they did support the 15th Amendment. Men were allowed in their organization. So there was a bit of problems there when it came to fighting for who was going to get the right to vote first. Eventually, they merge back together and they're reunited, and they start to when they become NASA, the National American Women's Suffrage Association, led by Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony again. And their strategy is to work to ratify state by state and change the voting laws in particular states. So a lot of Western states are considering allowing women the right to vote. And so they're going to campaign other state constitutions to change and give women the tools to fight for that way to change their state constitutions, as well as propose a constitutional amendment. And they don't really get anywhere with the constitutional amendment. Susan B. Anthony proposes it several times, but it stalls in the Senate. But at the same time, if you think about what's happening in the United States, it's the progressive era. There are women fighting for all different kinds of social issues. They're fighting against the abuse of alcohol with the temperance movement, which later turns into full-on prohibition. There are women fighting, advocating for immigrants. There are women fighting to improve city life and the, health of society. And so there's a lot of places for women to fight for labor, the labor movement, and better working conditions and wages. But they don't have the right to vote. And a lot of those women that are involved in those movements start to see how much more powerful they would be if they did have the vote. So they start to join organizations and build a broader coalition with NASA to put pressure on their legislators to ratify an amendment to the Constitution. But it's really not until World War II World War I, that they really show the world, like, listen, we have done so much on behalf of the war effort. The war could not have been won without the efforts and work of women on behalf of the war. And at that point, I'm sorry, can you still hear me?
Yes, yeah.
Okay. At that point, there is a bit of a break in the movement as well. The National Women's Suffrage Association doesn't want to be overly controversial, and the National Women's Party forms out of it, led by Alice Paul and Lucy Burns, who are more willing to use civil disobedience to get their point across. It doesn't start out that way. But Alice Paul was a Quaker, and she had learned from suffragettes in Britain. And she and members of the National Women's Party, or the NWP, began to target Woodrow Wilson specifically, that he didn't support women's suffrage or wouldn't publicly support women's suffrage. And as the leader of the Democratic Party, they shouldn't work with him or support him and other Democrats until he changed his mind. And so the Silent Sentinels began picketing in front of the White House in 1917, which was acceptable until the war started. And they eventually started charging them for obstructing traffic and sending them to various workhouses and district prisons to get them out of the way. It was quite embarrassing on the world stage when Woodrow Wilson is talking about spreading democracy around the world when women, which the NWP was pointing out, that women don't have democracy in the United States. So we look like we're hypocrites here. So while in prison, the women went on a hunger strike and were force-fed in prison. And so it's kind of the workings of so many years of so many different amazing women and different organizations, including African-American women's organizations that don't get as much attention, that hopefully we'll get to talk about here in a minute, but like the National Association of Colored Women, the Delta Sigma Thetas, there are many other groups that, helped work this way. So when Woodrow Wilson eventually supported ratification and Congress passed it on to the states, it wasn't easy. It was still state-by-state ratification. It was really fought against, but Tennessee became the final state necessary to ratify, like you said, as we celebrated on Tuesday.
Right. Well, what a great summary. Thank you for that. Let me just add that Kansas, where I live, gave women the right to vote in 1912 before the federal amendment. It was one of the earlier states, although the first state to give women the right to vote was Wyoming back in, I think, 1869. So what you said about the Western states being more progressive on women's right to vote is borne out, at least in Kansas.
Right.
Yeah. So there were a lot of divisions, as you said, in the movement, and a lot of people couldn't agree. I remember, the great labor leader Mother Jones thought the fight for suffrage was irrelevant. because, you know, men had the right to vote, and they hadn't achieved much with the voting. She was somebody who believed in striking and organizing and direct action. And so first, let me ask you, was there a working women's movement for suffrage, or did they pretty much sit it out?
There was a movement, but it was really challenging because there weren't very many organized labor unions on behalf of just women in the period after the Civil War. It's not until the turn of the century where we have more women who are allowed to join labor unions, or we had textile worker union mm-hmm. that was pretty powerful. But those women were working 14-hour days, 6 days a week. They couldn't take time off for work to go advocate on behalf of women's suffrage. But when you have a union, that's when you can build those coalitions and you have that power to represent this group of, unionized women or working women to participate. So that was something that when Alice Paul was a member of NASA before they split off, she had a parade in Washington, D.C., on the day before the inaugural of Woodrow Wilson, and it was a big suffrage parade. And she made sure that working women, laboring women were involved and could be seen and that they were actually, this is something they cared about, this is something they wanted. And when on various state-by-state campaigns, NASA and the WP spoke to men, laboring men, and said, listen, you want better wages and working conditions. Can you imagine if you doubled the working class vote? What if your wife could also vote? She could vote for these progressive candidates or, populist mm-hmm. candidates in some states at the time that want to fight for you and are not, heavily invested in corporate interests. So why wouldn't you want your wife to vote? And so they're trying to appeal to labor, whether it was the husband or the wife, to get involved or, to advocate on behalf of the vote.
Yeah. And, you mentioned that Black women were often very much marginalized, but Black movement was also split. And I mean, there was a lot of bitterness over the fight over the right to vote when the 15th Amendment was passed to the Constitution. I want to play a clip from a speech from Shirley Chisholm, one of my heroes, who was the first African-American woman to serve in Congress. And she served from 1968 to 1982, I think it was. And she represented Brooklyn, New York. And she gave this speech in 1983, and she talked about how those divisions lasted a long time. We're going to play this short clip from her.
We Blacks and we women, we did over time wring some important concessions from the males in power. And through the years, we have risen from the horizontal closer to the vertical. But we women and we Blacks did it separately. We did it as Blacks, or we did it as women. We each fought our own battles because we did not see, or we could not see, or we would not see that it was all the same battle for freedom and equality of opportunities. We have been marching down different sides of the same street, that are not to recognize it. But maybe finally, we are coming together and we are marching down, hopefully, the middle of the street.
So she was very optimistic. I'm not so sure she was correct that these movements have come together. There's been a lot of water under the bridge, so to speak, where the women's movement, even the reinvigorated women's movement in the 1960s, which modeled itself in many ways on the civil rights movement, but was quite separate. Do you have any comments on that and how the divisions really prolonged the cause and made it harder to win suffrage or other gains for women?
Well, it was a tricky situation for many of the suffrage leaders. Alice Paul was a Quaker who didn't believe in, segregation and racism. But, to be a politician, she needed to build a broader coalition, you know, to fight for the movement. And so in another example, going back to the parade, she Southern women groups refused to participate if they had to march in a desegregated parade. They wanted the African-American women in groups to march at the back. Mm-hmm. And African-American women groups threatened to, you know, not participate because of this. Mary Church Tyrell continued to participate in the Delta Sigma Thetas, but Ida B. Wells Barnett, who was from Chicago, really considered not participating. But during the parade, she stepped into the middle of the parade and marched on her own and did not comply. But that was a reason to fight against suffrage in the South. And so some Southern suffragists said, well, we're going to fight for the white women's vote, but not the black women's vote. Mm-hmm. And so they were looking to create their own constitutional amendments just to allow white women to vote. And that was because, again, they were afraid of the black women's vote because they were worried that it would double the African-American vote in the South, even though Jim Crow laws had already begun to form and black men were not able to actually vote in the South. So, you know, there were all of these concessions, but it left people behind and the racism persisted. And so even, you know, when you look at the modern feminist movement, a lot of feminists of the 60s and 70s didn't always do the best job of making it an intersectional, you know, fight for women's advancement. And so I think the movement today is, you know, it's basically, it's not feminism if it's not intersectional. If you're not thinking about race, class, and ethnicity at certain points when you're talking about fighting for women's equality.
Well, we can hope that that's a lesson we've learned, because I think this is just a great example of how racism in America has held back so many people from gaining their rights, specifically women. I think that's one of the lessons from the suffrage movement, but I think there's some other lessons from the suffrage movement as well. Lessons, you know, gained from the tactics they used. I think it's really interesting that they didn't really get traction until they started doing civil disobedience. Do you think that's a lesson?
I think it's part of it. I think they got more international attention because of the civil disobedience. I think if they continued on the state-by-state campaign, they would have eventually got there, but it would have taken much longer. So I think there is power in having a more radical organization working with a more moderate, because it drives the person of power, the group in power, to lean towards the moderate. So it's the same in the civil rights movement, you know. The moderates were considered the radicals until a more radical group shows up, and then they're like, well, we'll work with the non-protesters now. So I think that when we look at what women are fighting for today, you don't see as much of the civil disobedience. And there have been some examples I could tell you about in the Virginia campaign that what Virginia most recently ratified in January. But in general, it's a lot of people like me who have families, and it's a lot to put on the line to, you know, get arrested for the cause. And so but I do think that it would be beneficial to have some group out there of young people doing radical things mm-hmm. on behalf of the Equal Rights Amendment.
Well, yeah, and of course, there's some recent movies that show the radicalism both in the U.S. as well as in England of the radical feminists who went mm-hmm. to jail and did civil disobedience. One's called, I think, Iron Jaw Maidens. Is that it?
Iron Jaw Angels. Yeah,
Angels.
That's a great one.
Yeah. Yeah, I really recommend it. So, we're talking to Erica Benson of the 28MO movement to ratify the Equal Rights Amendment. And Erica's going to be speaking on Saturday through the Kansas City Public Library. And on our calendar, we're going to have a way you can find out about that. She'll be speaking at 10 a.m. virtually, I guess. And before we go to break, I just want to ask you, what did they expect to gain from the suffrage movement? How was this going to make everything so much better for all of us?
Thank you. I was going to, it's August 29th at 10 a.m. at the library event. We're having a panel of ERA advocates and legislators from across the country. So you can register on the library website. So thank you for posting that.
Oh,
and that's
good.
In coordination with the Women's Equality Coalition of Kansas City. You should check out their website. We do a lot of amazing work.
They have a Facebook page.
Yes. Yeah. So you can learn about their events and the amazing work that they do every day. Suffragists knew that the 19th Amendment wouldn't be enough. It was just the start. But without the vote, their power was always limited. And you couldn't get enough women elected into office to make greater change. And so that's why we see in 1923, Alice Paul and the NWP introduced the Equal Rights Amendment. And so they're going to fight for more legislation on behalf of women. And then they see that there is necessary to have more constitutional protection. So in first elections, when you look at the data, I mean, not every woman votes. And there are many women, specifically in southern states, that still feel like their husbands vote for them. So it's not necessary for them to vote. But the League of Women Voters is organized by Carrie Catman Chat. She is one of the presidents of NASA, and she forms the League of Women Voters to educate women voters and to say, hey, we've got the vote. Now we got to do something with it. So we're going to advocate for voting rights and to get women to actually go out and vote, which is and it's still a very important and powerful organization in existence today. But it doesn't, you know, I think a lot of them had hopes that this would elevate their status in the country to be seen as closer to full citizens, but they knew that it would not be the end all be all. It was still just the beginning.
Yeah. It's been a long struggle. So we're going to take a break and listen to some public service announcements and a wonderful song by Bev Grant. And stay on the line, Erica. We're going to have you back. And when you come back, I want to ask you about the Equal Rights Amendment, why we need it.
Thank you.
Eco Radio KC, a locally produced exploration of positive solutions to the ecological challenges we face as we work to create a healthier future for our community and the planet. Hear from regional and national guests, find out about upcoming events, and learn how to keep yourself and your family well. Tune in each week from 6 to 7 on Monday evenings or listen anytime at kkfi.org/podcasts.
Catch the Local Showcase every Thursday night on KKFI, where we highlight local musicians, poets, artists, and events from the Kansas City and surrounding areas. Curated and brought to you by a different KKFI host from week to week. That's the Local Showcase, every Thursday night from 8 to 10 p.m., right here on 90.1 FM, KKFI.
We have gathered into bars, done the same work as the men, with babies in our arms. But you won't find our stories in most history books you read. We were there, we're still here, fighting for the things we need. We were there in the factories, we were there.
And that's the wonderful song by Bev Grant, We Were There. You can find it online if you want to hear the whole thing. And before we get back to our guest, I don't want to forget to wish a happy birthday to Heartland Labor Forum volunteer Michael Savoir. Happy birthday, Michael. Live it up. So we're back, and I'm Judy Ansel, and we're talking about women's suffrage and the Equal Rights Amendment with Erica Benson from, I can never remember this, I don't know why, from Project 28MO to make the Equal Rights Amendment the 28th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. So, Erica, real briefly, give us a little synopsis of what the ERA is and its history. I know it was introduced in Congress by Congresswoman Shirley Chisholm, who I mentioned before, who gave a rousing speech. And one of the things she said is that even though she is both black and a woman, she has suffered more discrimination as a woman in politics than she had as an African American, which I thought really shocked a lot of people. But anyway, tell us about the ERA.
Okay, yeah, so it had been introduced and presented to Congress ever since 1923, and it was actually in the on the platforms of both parties after World War II. And there's a big, you know, with the creation of the United Nations, there's a big push for global human rights and, you know, men and women's equality. And so every constitution written since World War II has an ERA of its own form that says men and women are equal. And so there is, both parties have the ERA on their platform. And so it's, you know, it's getting closer to ratification. It passes through the Senate, but it stalls in the House. And there's a lot of power by one or two people when it's just in committee, and it stalls out. So when it's finally ratified, I mean, what the big thing is that there are so many laws here and there, and a lot of women are thinking, how many years is it going to take for women to, you know, reach better, more equality if we're just hammering out and filing lawsuits and fighting for laws in this state and that state? Why not have really fight for this constitutional amendment? So the amendment says equality of rights under the law shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of sex. And it gives, in Section 2, it gives Congress the authority to write laws to enforce it. And so why it's still necessary today is, number one, legislation. Laws can be repealed, weakened, not enforced, and Congress does not have the authority in the Constitution to write laws to promote gender equality. There have been many times when Congress has tried to write laws to promote gender equality, and it's been overturned by the Supreme Court because it's out of their jurisdiction. So they could write laws concerning things like violence against women, FGM, sex trafficking, employment situations like hiring, firing, advancement, pay equality, medical accommodations, especially starting in government, how the military handles sexual harassment and assault, discrimination in medical and safety research protocols, inherent discrimination, and like when you look at how the backlogs of untested rape kits and uninvestigated rape and crimes against women. So they would have the authority under the Constitution to write laws about those things. They don't have that now. And without that protection, any administration or any Congress could repeal laws. They could repeal Title IX. They could repeal...
didn't they just do that? Didn't the Trump administration just really weaken Title IX?
Parts of it, the power that women have to... file sex discrimination or not sex discrimination, sexual violence claims,
right,
and
right.
And yeah, on college campuses.
That's an example, right?
So that can happen when you don't have that constitutional protection. The second part is litigation. It would change the way courts view cases concerning gender discrimination. So the current standard for race, religion, or country of origin discrimination cases is strict scrutiny, which provides a 73% likelihood of winning, and courts use strict scrutiny when reviewing those cases. Currently, gender discrimination cases receive intermediate scrutiny, and because of this, the likelihood of winning a case is only around 47%. The burden of proof is on the woman, and it's much harder to prove that somebody purposely discriminated against you. So there's an example of several women who filed suit against Walmart for discrimination, a class action lawsuit for discrimination in promotion and pay, Betty Dukes was the lead on that. And it was appealed all the way to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court said, you haven't proved that there's a single identifiable practice, that they were doing it on purpose. So unconscious bias does not count. But if the ERA was a part of the Constitution, or when, I should say, it is part of the Constitution in the 28th Amendment, they will review it at the same strict scrutiny as race. So if somebody, if there was a bunch of people that said, hey, we were discriminated because of our race, the level of the burden of proof is off of the claimants. And so it gives you a lot better chance of winning. So because there's no guarantee of gender equality, gender violence cases are decided on constitutional clauses like the Due Process Clause and the Commerce Clause. So it would give women the power to fight systematic pay inequity, again, violence against women, access to birth control, enforcement of restraining orders, and equal protection under the law and equal justice.
Okay. So there's so many. Let me stop. Cases. Yeah, let me stop you there because I want to ask you. So it sounds great. Why can't we get this thing passed? Who's against it, and what are their arguments?
So the House. Right now, the required number of states have ratified the ERA, 38 states. Virginia was the final state needed. Right now, the challenge is that there was an eight-year deadline attached in the preamble when the amendment was first passed by Congress, and they added an extension to it, and it still didn't get the number of states required. So the deadline in the preamble expired. And so since then, the necessary states have ratified. And so those who oppose it sometimes say, oh, we just believe in the, you know, we believe it's expired and you need to start all over again, you know.
So who are those people and why do they hate the ERA?
Well, it's Missouri. Missouri legislators and many southern states. It's just been a really hard-fought battle. Some of it is cultural, like some of it is religious, that people still believe women just have a different role in life, and so that it's unnecessary to have the Equal Rights Amendment, and that it would hurt families and households. You still hear the very stereotypical responses about, who the breadwinner is, and so much of this is fighting for women who are only paid 50 cents to 77 cents to a man's dollar. So we're talking about, you know, women's ability to save for their retirement or pay for medical insurance or help their kids.
So let me ask you this. It sounds like, you know, like it's really all about money. But aren't these people arguing about things like bathrooms?
Yes. In some states, they're worried about there's transphobia. There's worry that, you know, the way that sex is more broad, that it could be allow more rights for all gendered people. And so there is a new growing transphobia and concern for certain states and certain state legislators and congressmen that don't want to provide those rights to people and are worried about, you know, what happens on behalf of sports and bathrooms and those sorts of things. And the answer is it's going to come back to the courts, but we who advocate for it hope that it's as inclusive as possible and it can be a gateway for rights for all people, just the way that the 14th Amendment was used by women to advocate for more rights. So there's that. There are also men that are worried that it will allow women to have more control over their medical decisions than they currently have. And again, that's in cases where, in states that do have equal rights amendments, usually when they're determining cases about women's medical treatments, they continue to use the privacy provision and the looking at the article, the privacy constitutional protections. So there are people that are worried about that as well.
Okay, we don't have much time. Is corporate America for or against the ERA?
It's for the ERA now. They've signed an amicus brief supporting a most recent lawsuit to go ahead and add the ERA to the Constitution. If you go to our website, you can see the companies.
Companies? I'm sorry? You mean corporations have?
Corporations, companies, Google, Goldman Sachs, you know, any big major corporation, there are about 90 companies that recently signed on to say that they support the Equal Rights Amendment.
Okay, you've got 1 minute left. How are we going to get Missouri to pass the ERA?
Well, we don't need Missouri anymore because we have the necessary number of states. So it'd be great if Missouri did it, but we don't have to. Right now, we need our U.S. Senate to pass SJ Res 6, which eliminates the old deadline. The House of Representatives eliminated the old deadline in the preamble, and now the Senate can too. It's stuck in the Senate Judiciary Committee. Senator Lindsey Graham is holding it up, but our Senator Josh Hawley is in that committee, and we've met with him. And so he does have the power to help advance the Equal Rights Amendment, and he is on that committee. So we need it to have a hearing, get voted on so that it can come to the Senate floor where it does have an actual chance of passing. And that way the ERA will be certified as the 28th Amendment in 2020. If the Senate has to be flipped for that to happen, that's a possibility too. And we, under new presidential leadership, the next president could ask the National Archivist to go ahead and add it right now.
Okay, so we've been talking to Erica Benson from the project to get the 28th Amendment into the Constitution. That would be the Equal Rights Amendment. And what she's saying is that you should call Josh Hawley. Is that right, Erica?
Yeah.
Call Josh Hawley and tell
both
him
of them.
And tell him to get the Senate to pass this resolution, which would allow it to be put into the Constitution.
Exactly.
Okay. Thank you so much. And stay tuned now for Know Your Rights, which is going to be talking about employment discrimination.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right.
Good evening, Kansas City. This is Angie Williams with the Law Offices of Angela L. Williams with another edition of Know Your Rights. Today I thought I'd talk a little bit about discrimination in employment. The Missouri Human Rights Act makes it illegal to discriminate in any aspect of employment because of someone's race, color, religion, national origin, sex, disability, or age. Some cities may have broader anti-discrimination ordinances that also include sexual orientation and gender identity. The state of Missouri does not. But a number of the municipalities in the greater Kansas City area do. So make sure that you check out the city that you live in to see what their stance is on these issues if you feel like you have been a victim of discrimination. So this discrimination can take many forms. It can be also related to hiring and firing, compensation or classification of employees, assignments to different work positions, transfers, promotions, layoffs, recalls, recruitment, testing, fringe benefits, pay, retirement, disability leave. All of these things can be something that you may be discriminated against based on one of those protected categories. This can also take some other less obvious forms. And that could include harassment based on one of the categories. But it also can include things like retaliation against an individual for filing a complaint or for participating in an investigation or a hearing or for standing up for discriminatory practices within the workplace. It can also include denying employment opportunities because of a person's marriage to or association with a particular race, religion, national origin, or individual with a disability, where people might go to worship if they're being discriminated against because of a religious aspect, also ethnic groups particularly, as opposed to racial groups, those are both prohibited, or discrimination against both of those is prohibited as well. And also asking certain pre-employment questions might also be discrimination. So for example, if you're in a job interview, for example, a national origin question or ancestry that they might be prohibited from asking, you shouldn't ask, where were you born? You can ask maybe what's your current address and phone number. Do you have any alternative locations where you can be reached? For religion, you can ask, for example, what days might you be available to work? But you should not ask, what religion do you practice? Similarly, you might be able to ask, are you able to work with our required schedule? But you shouldn't say, what religious holidays do you observe? Age, you might ask about career goals, or if you're over the age of 18, you shouldn't ask things like, how much longer do you plan on working before retirement? That indicates that you're maybe planning on discriminating against someone because of their age. Relation to sex and gender. One of the things that might be able to be asked, which is a good question, is, are you available to work overtime on occasion, or can you travel? You should not ask, do you have or do you plan on having children? Do you have childcare that is available on short notices for overnight stays? Regarding disabilities, you probably shouldn't ask someone, do you have any disabilities, or have you had any recent or past illnesses or operations? You might be able to ask if they are able, if the applicant is able to perform specific job duties. If you feel like you might have been the victim of discrimination either within your job or in a hiring situation, you need to contact the Missouri Commission on Human Rights or the Equal Opportunity Employment Council. Both of these types of cases for discrimination have time limits, and which are called statute of limitations, that may apply. So if you think that you've been a victim of this, it's best to seek legal advice sooner rather than later so you don't miss out on one of your rights. That's all the time we have today, Kansas City. I hope everybody's staying safe. This is Angie Williams with the Law Offices of Angela L. Williams with another edition of Know Your Rights. Wear your masks. Be safe, Kansas City.
And this is the Heartland Labor Forum calendar. Our calendar is posted on the Heartland Labor Forum Facebook page. And since so many events are online and you need a link, that's where you can get the link for these events. So, Tuesday, August 25th, The Asylum Crisis, Migration, Imperialism, and Racism in Central America, sponsored by the Cross Border Network. You can go to crossbordernetwork.org to register, and it is on Tuesday at 6:30 p.m. on Zoom. Next week is the annual Pushing Back, Marching Forward series of events commemorating women's suffrage. All of these are on the Women's Equality GKC Facebook page. Here are the highlights. Wednesday, August 26th, 10:30 a.m., Voting Rights and Voting Suppression. It's a panel discussion. Thursday, August 27th, 6:30, Thinker, Sex Suffrage and the Extraordinary Life of Helen Hamilton Gardner with historian Kimberly Hamlin. That's a KC Library event, which you can find on the KC Library webpage. And then Saturday with Erica Benson, who you just heard on the Heartland Labor Forum. She's speaking from 10 to 11:30 a.m. And her topic is Equal Rights Should Have No Deadline. All of these events, again, are on the Women's Equality GKC Facebook page for links and details. And then March on Kansas City for Justice and Peace, Friday, September 4th, 3 to 5 p.m., March from 12th and Locust to the World War I Memorial. This is sponsored by the Southern Christian Leadership Council, the Urban League, the Urban Summit, Communities Creating Opportunities, Missouri Jobs with Justice, and many others. That's it for tonight's show. Tune in next week. Our show is called Sports Unions and Black Lives Matter. Thanks to tonight's engineer, Jen Zaman.
But I was too young to see.
to the Heartland Labor Forum, a show by and about workers, our workplaces, and our labor movement. We are radio that talks back to the boss, and you can talk back too. Send us your workplace stories, news, and ideas for shows to heartlandlaborforumkkfi@gmail.com. Our website, where we archive shows and post our upcoming schedule, is heartlandlaborforum.org. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any of the unions involved. Tune in every Thursday evening to the Heartland Labor Forum at 6 o'clock or to our Friday morning rebroadcast at 5 o'clock right here at 90.1 FM KKFI.